When I was in college, it was not even a thought in my mind to become a professional rider. That was like a non-job.
Welcome to the Major League Eventing Podcast, the show for eventing fans by eventing fans. Time to braid.
Mane and Tail has the best product for that, Karen. The spray and braid.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes, spray and braid. So some of the benefits is no slip grip for easy braiding and banding. Eliminates flyaway strands for perfect looking braids. Protein enriched strengthens hair. Helps prevent breakage. The ultimate solution for training manes and tails to lay flat. It's a water-based pH balanced formula with a pleasant scent. And it's ergonomic bottle is easy to use.
Everyone needs a good ergonomic bottle when you're braiding. Your hands hurt enough as it is when you're braiding.
Right.
The last thing you need is some sort of bottle that's awkward. So thank you so much, Mane and Tail. Nothing but the best. Thank you so much, Mane and Tail. Get out there. If you love the show, please support the sponsors. And Mane and Tail is a huge, huge sponsor.
Love them.
When it comes to insurance, there's only one person to call to cover all of your insurance needs. Whether it's for your horse, your farm, your home, or business, Trish Scott has you covered. Her number is 484-319-8923. Trish was a guest on the show just a few weeks ago, and we were talking about insurance. And after talking to her, it really got me thinking, I am not fully insured. I got insurance, yeah, but I'm not properly insured. So think about this. Do you have tack? Is your horse insured? Is your trailer insured? Do you have rental insurance? If you teach, do you have insurance in case someone gets hurt while you're teaching them, whether on your property or off? These are all some serious, serious things to think about. If you have any questions about if you are properly insured, just give Trish a call at 484-319-8923 to discuss your plan, and she'll look it over and she'll tell you if you're properly insured. So give her a ring, 484-319-8923, and tell her Karen and Rob from Major League Eventing sent you. Triple Crown Feed.
Oh, Karen. Yeah.
Triple Crown, big fans of Triple Crown Feed. They have tons of great products out there,
mm-hmm.
Premium stuff. Karen, what do you got to say over there?
So Triple Crown has formulas that are tailored to your horse's unique needs and help support immunity and gut health. Find your local Triple Crown Feed dealer by going to triplecrownfeed.com.
TripleCrownFeed.com. That's a little bit of a tongue twister.
TripleCrownFeed.com.
They have a great feed locator. They have a great feed comparison tool on their website. I encourage everyone to get over there. Check out Triple Crown Feed's website. Check out the different products. Check out what makes them so special. And give them a shot, right, Karen?
Oh, yeah.
Support the people to support the show.
Spring has sprung, and that means the bugs are coming back out.
Yeah, protect your horse with the Fly Turtle by Turtleneck. So like all Turtleneck blankets, they have the patented stretch features. But the Fly Turtle also comes with deep sides with belly flaps that tuck under your horse for even that much more protection from mosquitoes and flies and other gnats and nasty bugs like that.
Yeah, very important.
Absolutely. So it has 60% UV protection from the sun and a one-year warranty, Karen.
Right, and it comes with a detachable neck cover.
Yeah, and a spare parts kit.
Of course,
it's Turtleneck. They all come with that. So they come in sizes 65 to 86,
mm-hmm.
and they fit just perfect your horse. If your horse is allergic to bugs, gnats, flies, you want the best for your horse. You don't want it breaking out. This is the Fly Turtle is for you.
Right, and the mesh is waterproof and will not retain moisture.
Yeah, that's super important.
Yes, it is.
You don't want moisture sitting on your horse and just getting funky on your horse's skin. So for sizing and temperature guidelines for all Turtleneck blankets, go to turtleneck.biz and order yours today. Fairfax in favor, Karen. You know, some people come up to me sometimes and they say, Rob, don't you get jealous that Karen gets all the Fairfax in favor stuff? And I say, fear not to the men.
Yeah, they have men's too.
Men's stuff. They're the best men's stuff. Amazing men's stuff. So, Karen, what are some of the men's shoes that they carry?
So, they have the Nelson, which is a leather boot. They have the Trafalgar, which is another ankle boot. They have the Sterling.
I really like the Sterling. It's a lace-up like short ankle boot. Very cool.
Very cool.
The Benningfield loafers, Karen. I love them.
Yeah,
they got blue suede shoes, Karen.
They do. And they have little tassels on them.
I love blue suede shoes, Karen.
And they have the Edward, which is a gilet for men.
A men's gilet for me, Karen. So very, very cool. We love Fairfax and Favor.
We sure do.
Don't forget, they can gift wrap.
Yes, they can
gift wrap when you want to buy for yourself. They can give you an alibi.
Yeah, I was about ready to mention that.
Yep.
Get your alibi.
Yeah, get your alibi at fairfaxandfavor.com. Treat yourself. I'm Rob.
And I'm Karen. And Rob's super excited about today's guest.
Oh, yeah.
She's a very busy lady.
Very busy lady.
Very busy lady. Welcome to the show, five-star rider, 2022 USEA Area 3 Young Rider Coach, a sports psychology coach, University of Florida eventing coach, and a bunch of other things. Welcome to the show, Ashley Johnson.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Wow. And Karen didn't even read the whole list.
I
started snoozing over here. The list was long. I started dozing on. No, just kidding. Ashley, you do it all. It's like we were saying a little bit before the interview, we like to have riders on and officials on and coaches. On. And it's like, so everything you do, Ashley, you fit the bill. So we could have just had Ashley on 200 guests ago and it would have just been like, all right, we're all done.
I like how Karen said, and a whole bunch of other things, because that's kind of my life. I have my fingers in a lot of pies.
I like it because I like diversity. I don't know if you're like me. We'll get into it a little bit more, but I'm kind of type of person who I like a lot of things. Like I have lots of interests, and so I get deep into those interests.
Yes,
I'll shift off to a new interest.
Like, wait a minute, what happened to this?
You know, but so I don't know if that's you, if you just have like a ton of interest, so you just dive in feet first in all of them. Is that how you are?
I've definitely always had a lot of interests, and I'm really passionate about many of them. I don't tend to, I tend to kind of stay in one for long periods. So I don't tend to jump from one to the other to the other. I tend to try to marry them all together. So like each one informs the other one to a certain degree. But I've always been a person that really, I have a lot of curiosity about things. And so I constantly want to learn.
Yes, just like me.
Yes.
I'm a very curious person.
You're very curious.
And I can talk to almost anybody about almost anything because at some point in time, I was interested in whatever they do. So I don't know. I'm just that type of weirdo. But I don't put any of it to work. I mean, all of it's just hobbies and, anyway, enough about me, Karen.
Right. So, Ashley, you're coming to us via Zoom and we could see you and it looks beautiful behind you. So where are you coming to us from?
So I have a farm in Ocala, Florida. I started coming down to, I grew up in New Jersey. I was born in New Jersey and I grew up in central New Jersey. And then after college, I moved to a place called Plymouth Meeting right outside of Philadelphia and rode for a family, the Weatherall family. And they're an old mainline family that's been around the Philadelphia area for a long time. So I was really lucky, very blessed to work for Mr. Elkins Weatherall. And I ran his barn. I took him fox hunting. I was, his girl. He also owned some event horses that I competed, and really a lot of luck to have his backing and his support, which helped me move into the upper levels of eventing. And so way too long ago to even think about, I had a horse competing. I think I was just starting to compete advanced. And I saw that people were going to Florida or going south in the winter. And so I was pretty young. I was 23. So I was my first year out of college. And we had this good horse. And I said, Mr. Weatherall, rather than me stay and ride circles in the indoor all winter, maybe I should take this horse. At that time, I went to Aiken because I was training with Philip Dutton and he was in Aiken. And so I said, what do you think about me going to Aiken for a couple weeks? And he thought that was a great idea. So I went to Aiken, and that was, I don't remember, a 9 or 10 hour drive from where I was. And when I was in Aiken, and it was cold and rainy and pretty miserable, I saw a horse show in Altoona, Florida called Rocking Horse. And it was about 8 hours. The GPS said it was 8 hours away. And I thought, well, I'm already here. I may as well just pop down to Florida and do this horse show. So I did. And it was 72 degrees and blue sky and puffy clouds. And the footing was amazing. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm coming here next year. And so that was it. Then I just started coming to Florida, and eventually I bought a place down here, and here I am.
Nice.
That'll do it.
That'll do it. I would definitely, we were just down in Florida not too long ago, and it was like, yeah, I could stay.
Yeah.
I could stick around for
yeah.
a little bit.
Yeah.
I definitely get. And Aiken is beautiful. While Aiken's beautiful and very nice and, you know, has all the
it's
good.
It's still cold.
It's still cold. Like if you know, if you're going to.
Or at least when we go, it's cold.
It's still, you still have, you know, the blankets and the wet and the, it is a beautiful town. And I go to Aiken also, and Florida is incredibly hot in the summer. So, you know, there are drawbacks everywhere, but, I was able to purchase a farm down here. And so I'm here full time now. So I mean, I would love to go, I don't know, Kentucky or back north in the summer, some of the time, but I also love being at the farm. So it all works out.
Yeah. Heck yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about. I can go for some summer heat. I like it hot. So.
I do too. So Ashley, you told us a little bit about your history, but can you take us back and tell us how you got your start in riding and then into the sport of eventing?
Yes. So my mom loved horses when she was a child, and my grandfather was very outdoorsy and my grandmother was not. She was kind of a city girl, and she felt that riding horses was not ladylike. And so she, even though my mom clearly loved horses and always wanted to pet the horses anytime she saw horses, she was never allowed to learn to ride. And so when I was 2 and a half, and my brother's 3 years older than me, we lived in a town called Hopewell, New Jersey, and we had maybe 3/4 acre. And there was this pony at Terhune Orchards, which was the local apple orchard. And they would give pony rides on the pony. And at the end of the season, Terhune Orchards didn't want to keep the pony for the winter. So one day the pony showed up in our backyard because mom bought the pony. And we didn't have a fence. We didn't have anything. We tied him to a stake at first. I remember that. So, and then my parents built a garden wall. So for a brief period, he was kind of housed in the garden, and we would put cat food out the back door for the cats. And the pony's name was Kenny, and Kenny would come over and try and eat the cat food. So he didn't stay out on that property that long. Mom found a field for him down the street. But that is how I started riding. When I was in second grade, there was a show and tell at my elementary school, and mom arranged to walk Kenny, because I walked to school. I lived close to my elementary school. So she walked Kenny over to the school, and everybody in my class got a ride around the baseball diamond on Kenny. And so when I went to my 10-year, or I don't know, the first high school reunion that I went to when we were all adults, almost everybody there came over and said, you know, my best elementary school memory was riding your pony around the baseball diamond.
That's funny.
So, but it, you know, all of this is to say, we didn't know anything. My dad is a retired college professor. So he was, you know, he was teaching at Rutgers, and he bought there was a utility trailer, and he built like a front kind of plywood screen. So we'd put Kenny on this utility trailer with this plywood kind of shield. And in the summer, we had a summer house in Maine. So every year in June, we would pack the station wagons and the cats and the dogs and the goldfish and the hamsters and the bunnies and whatever animals we had all in the cars. And Kenny would ride behind us on the utility trailer. And you see him stick his little nose out and his mane would be flying. And then on the other side of the utility trailer were the family bicycles. And so we'd do that every summer when I was a kid. Wow. So how I got into eventing is my very first horse show was a little Western 4-H show in Maine. But when I was about 8, my mom signed me up for the United States Pony Club, and we went to a rally that was an eventing rally. And this was a different pony. So we'd progressed and this was a little pony called Cherokee, and I fell off, not even at a jump. The jumps were like hay bales. I just came around a turn really fast and I just fell off, lost my balance, fell off. And I remember laughing as I was in the air and thinking that it was so much fun. And at the end of the day, I said, Mom, I want to do more of that.
That's awesome. So did you coach, you know, being in that part of Jersey, I mean, I would imagine there was some good coaching and things like that around. Did you get all your, did you learn all your eventing through the Pony Club and coaches like that? Or what did you?
So my primary eventing coach growing up was Carol Ann Blackman. She's in Ringo's, New Jersey. And then I had, I also had a great coach called Jean-Paul Murat, and he's French, and he just was a very classically trained horseman. So he was technically a show jumping rider, but I think I learned a lot from him about just classical horsemanship. And I had two great dressage instructors as well, Monica Sinks and Ed Morrison. So Mom kind of sought out she wound up being the DC of my pony club, and she sought out trainers that she thought were good trainers for everybody in my club to use. She's a real haggler. She would go to them and she would say, well, I have these 6 pony club kids that need lessons. And if, you know, could you agree to doing 6 weeks of lessons and discount your rate 40%? I mean, I don't know the details, but she would go and she'd get the lessons discounted so that we could all afford them.
Wow. That's really cool.
It is cool.
Mom didn't know anything about horses and she became the DC. That's pretty awesome. The head honcho. Did the pony club? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, my mom's love of horses has carried through, because eventually, when I was in college, she discovered mounted games and she started coaching mounted games, and so now this summer she's traveling to Ireland as the United States International Mounted Games coach.
Oh, that's so cool!
Awesome. Shout out to Pony Club. I was actually, I was an officer or a committee member. I shouldn't say an officer, a committee member for Tetrathlon and International exchange programs. Mm-hmm. So a big shout out to the international exchanges for anyone that wants that experience. That's really cool. So she's the coach this year. That's really cool. Really competitive. Those kids are.
That's fun to watch.
It's fun to watch and they are good. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
She's going to have a good time. Where are they going?
They're going to Ireland. Oh. I think they're competing at Mill Street, at the showgrounds where Mill Street is.
Okay.
Wow. Lots of fun. Lots of fun.
That'd be fun.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. So when did you start, through high school and all, were you getting real serious and like up the levels in eventing, or was it always just kind of like for fun, or what? Tell us about that.
So I was very academically motivated. So when I was in high school, in junior high, I played soccer. I played basketball. I was in the drama club. So I did Girl Scouts when I was a little kid also. So I always had a lot of other activities going on. In junior high, I kind of had to make a decision going into high school if I wanted to play soccer in the fall or compete on my horse, which by that point, we'd moved to a little 3-acre property that had a tiny barn, and we had like two horses in the backyard. So I had my horse in the backyard, and it was right down the street from school, and I would just trailer into town or through town to go to riding lessons. So anyway, I remember sitting down and making like a pros and cons list between doing horse trials and playing soccer. And I wanted to do horse trials. And, you know, and at that point, I wasn't in a program with a professional. I was a person who would ship in to do lessons. So there was a lot of stuff I didn't know. but Mom knew that every winter when we would take a break from riding because of the weather and because of basketball and daylight and all of that, every spring I would come out and I was a hot mess. And I kind of had to go through this re-entry into remembering how to ride. And I think I was competitive enough and I enjoyed it. I mean, I absolutely enjoyed and loved having my horses at home. And throughout my life, the being able to go out to the barn and be with my horses has been really, really important to me. But also competing and feeling like I was proficient at it and good at it and learning from it was really fun. So it kind of slowly took precedence over everything else. So that list, you know, deciding between soccer and horseback riding and learning how to do that for myself. When I was choosing where I went to college, Rutgers was not, I went to Rutgers. My dad taught at Rutgers. It was not my top choice. And I actually, as a transfer student, my sophomore year, I was accepted at Columbia and Brown. And so, you know, that was like, oh, big deal. And I sat down and I made my list. And at Rutgers, I was able to ride. I was able to keep my horse close, either at home or at a barn close to campus. And at the end of the day, I didn't want to give up riding. And I felt that the academics at Rutgers, it's different than going to a private university, but there were very good professors that, you know, that I was able to seek out and find. And so I was happy with the academic program and I got to continue riding. But as far as upper level riding, I competed prelim for the first time when I was 14, and I was riding a paint quarter horse paint called Mr. Piebald, and he made it to prelim with me. He was the best little guy. He was 15, two hands. He just tried his heart out, and we were kind of touching on young riders. And I was schooling a jump and he cut himself, like he cut his belly because he scraped the bottom of the jump. And it scared me for him because I thought, you know, he tried his little heart out for me and I didn't want him to get hurt. And I felt like going prelim was kind of maxing out his, and this was, you know, prelim is a lot different now. This was more at the time you just gallop at the jumps. You gallop at the jumps and they're bigger. It wasn't as technical that, you know, it was just a different sport at that time. But basically suffice it to say, I didn't feel that I had the skill to support him. And I knew that it was kind of the top of his ability level. So I didn't do young riders. He wound up retiring. I got a thoroughbred. I didn't do prelim again for several years. But I focused on getting my A through Pony Club.
Wow. And then you got that A, right? So you are an A graduate now?
I did. I got that A when I was between my junior and my senior year. I was 17.
Wow. Okay. Were you able to, did you borrow a horse since you had to retire that horse, or did you have another horse that was able to do the upper level jumping and everything?
We got 1 year for Christmas. I went out to the barn and Mom had bought me a 3-year-old Belgian thoroughbred cross. So he's a Belgian warm blood with half thoroughbred. And with the help of my trainers, we trained him, and that's who I did my ratings on.
Wow. Wow. That's impressive.
That is.
Wow. Really impressive.
Very cool.
Very, very cool. So now you went to college. Did you, you know, was your mindset in college, okay, I'm going to get my education, but then I'm going to go back and be a professional? Had you decided to be a professional at that point, or can you take us through that? Because we always ask that question about college, and, you know, a lot of people that listen, you know, it's like we had that debate, go to college, don't go to college. You know, when did you know you wanted to be a professional? So could you share that kind of with us?
Absolutely. When I was in college, it was not even a thought in my mind to become a professional rider. That was like a non-job. So when I was in college, I traveled. I really wanted to see the different parts of the world. So my uncle had been in the Peace Corps in Africa, and he went to visit Africa, and I hitched a ride. I said, "Uncle Roland, I want to go with you." So I did that one summer. I did exchange programs in Italy. I did a environmental program in South America in the rainforest. So I really put like upper level competitive riding on the back burner. I had a thoroughbred in college, and maybe we made it to training level. I mean, he was pretty rank. But in any case, so after I graduated, and somewhere in the mix, Mom was able to find me an advanced level horse that had fallen and kind of lost his nerve and was being sold very inexpensively. And, his name was Broomfield Warning. And so we bought him, and I wound up competing him prelim again. So that was when I got back to prelim, and he would stop sometimes, but he really taught me to ride what the ride was for an upper level horse, because he did know his job. I mean, he wasn't happy to do huge jumps, but he just had to do prelim with me, and he was a good horse for me. But the deal always was with my parents that so at Rutgers, because my dad was a professor there, I got tuition remission, which means that they didn't have to pay tuition for me. So my parents said, "We are not paying tuition for you. We're paying your living expenses and, you know, for you to have a car, and we will pay for your horse and for riding lessons while you're in college, because you're not going to a private university. And when you graduate, we are not paying for anything anymore." And so when I graduated, Mom sold Broomfield Warning, and I was on my own. And at that time, it wasn't in my mind that I was going to be a professional. It was more, okay, I'm on my own financially. I need to figure this out. And I really wanted to work in New York City, because I grew up, you know, an hour and a half away, and it was glamorous and big deal. So I got a job at, I was an art history minor, and I also spoke French. I had taken French all through high school, and I lived in Paris for a summer during college. So don't ask me to speak French now. I don't think I speak French anymore, but I got a job at Christie's Auction House.
Wow.
And it was a job that, so I was working with fine art, and I was living in New York City, And the job that I had was cataloging. I mean, this was also pretty amazing to me, coming from my background. It was a different world, because so you had these items of artwork that people would send to get auctioned, and I was in the modern art department, and the warehouse was right there with the office on the Upper East Side. So people would send these items of artwork to the auction, and maybe they wouldn't sell, or sometimes people would buy artwork at the auction and then they would forget to either pick it up or get it shipped. So it would just sit there in the warehouse. So my first job at Christie's was to go through the shelves and find the items of artwork that were basically just sitting there and get them to the owner, either return them to the owner or send them to the new owner. And so that was just pretty amazing that people had that much money that they didn't care where their artwork that was worth tens of thousands of dollars was, or more. But when I was there, so I'd been there a couple months, I'd lived in the city. I was not feeling like, I mean, it was fun, but I was like, you know, I don't know that I'm really a New Yorker. It takes a really long time to actually get to the country when you're in New York. And all of the things that my New Yorker friends thought were really cool, like the latest shape of sunglasses, or where you could go to get a coffee, I didn't think any of that was really cool. I missed riding. So one day I was pulling the paintings out from the shelves, and I pulled out a small painting, and I didn't know the painting, but I could tell it was by Picasso, because I knew the style. And my whole life, you know, you go to museums and you have to stand at a distance from artwork. You never are holding a famous piece of art in your hand. I mean, it's not the normal thing. Even as an art history minor, where I looked at a lot of artwork, it wasn't like you were holding it. And it was just beautiful. It was just a beautiful, vibrant, the colors, they kind of just glowed. And I was looking at it and I was like, this guy was an absolute master. It just inspired me, the technique. And it's not that I'm a huge Picasso fan, but just the depth of the colors and the way that he had painted it were just beautiful. And for whatever reason, it made a jump, there was a jump in my mind. It bridged this gap. And I thought, you know, that what my creative process is training horses, and I'm talented at it, and I can make a difference to these horses. And that was what made me so not that I felt like I was Picasso, but I felt like that was where I could make a contribution. And so that's what made me decide to move home and buy an off-track thoroughbred and kind of start from scratch.
Wow. That's incredible. And from then until you became, like, did you immediately kind of become like full time with the horses at that time, or did you find some other work close to, you know, in the country?
I waitressed. So the first year I had a waitressing job, and I also, even as a teenager, I started teaching lessons to the younger pony clubbers when I was probably 16. So I just went back to that. I said, hey, I'm back in the area. I got an apartment. I waitressed and I started teaching lessons, and I started going and riding horses for people. And within a year, Mr. Weatherall, I taught his grandchildren. And so he was looking for somebody to run his barn. He was 80 and he needed somebody to go fox hunting with him because, maybe he was jumping things that he shouldn't have been jumping. So I went and met with him. And so about a year after moving out of New York and getting this apartment, he offered for me to come to his place and run his barn. And he said, oh, I'll buy you an event horse. And I mean, it was just this unbelievable stroke of luck. I felt like literally the luckiest person on the planet, that everything that I'd ever dreamed of just kind of came to me. And it was, you know, it was a lot of hard work and a very steep learning curve also, but I was really lucky. I mean, I was really blessed and really lucky that both because of the education. So Rob, going back to your, should you go to college or should you not go to college? You should go to college. That is 100% my opinion. That is why I coach the University of Florida eventing team, because I believe that you can do both things. And I would not have gotten the job with, I would not have been the person that his daughter would have suggested, or I was the person that his daughter suggested to him, because I had an education. I was able to string thoughts together. I was worldly. And what he really needed was a buddy, like somebody to go riding with and somebody to talk to. And he was an extremely intelligent man. He was a World War II veteran. He was the president of the Philadelphia Stock Exchange. And so the fact that I had an education made me in that position much more valuable to him.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, there we go. Ba-boom. Wow. And a discussion. Now I get it. Hey, that's quite the story.
It is.
And you're holding that art in your hand. I was hoping you're going to say, so I put that art in my back pocket and I sold it on the black market and bought my barn in Ocala. But no, that would have been great, but I wasn't.
No.
That's crazy. So let's fast forward. That's a fantastic story.
It is.
You have so many things that you do today. So I want to make sure we don't, you know, run out of time talking about all these fantastic things that you do now. So, you know, you've ridden, you know, you've competed 5-star, you coach, you do all this stuff. Can you tell us a little bit about all the different things that you do, you know, from riding, coaching, and then your sports psychology and all the other things. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. So I rode for Mr. Weatherall. He passed away in 2011. I kind of had to choose where I wanted to base myself, and I decided that Florida was a great spot. So I wound up moving here full time. And in 2011, I bought an off-track thoroughbred from a friend of mine for a couple of $1,000s. He had never been to horse trials, but my friend was a working student for Bruce Davidson. So we'd had him and schooled him and all of that. And I bought him, and about a week after I bought him, I took him beginner novice at Rocking Horse, and going cross country, the horse was just light on his feet, had a rhythmic gallop or rhythmic canter. And I thought, I think this might be my Kentucky horse. Wow. And he was brown and he was scruffy and, he didn't like dressage very much, but I believed in him. And it was really a goal. And I had been riding advanced, but it was really a goal in my heart to make it to the 5-star level. And so I chose to not try to get owners at that time, because I didn't want, Mr. Weatherall was a fabulous owner, but I my life was in transition. And I didn't want to feel like I was going to let anybody down if I didn't go to a show, or if we didn't do well, or if the season was different than we thought. So I owned, the horse's name is Tactical Maneuver. I call him Gucci. So I owned Gucci myself and taught a lot of lessons and sold horses and ran the business and paid for myself all through the levels, you know, from beginner novice all the way to 5-star. And we made it, and it was just an incredible experience. And I just, you know, he was really a heart horse for me. So we competed at Kentucky a couple of times. And in 2018, I knew he was getting a little older. And I had another horse. You know, I do have another horse that's a couple of years younger than him, but it's an Irish sport horse mare. And she just didn't quite have the gallop. So she made it through 4-star, and she just wasn't going to be a 5-star horse. And I know some people are happy to sell their horses and find something different, but I kind of commit to my horses. So I thought, you know, I would like to branch out in my life in a different way. And I wasn't sure what that was going to mean. So in 2018, I took the first course of my judge's licensing courses, and I took a class in the thought, you know, I had a conversation with my mom about grad school, and she said, well, why don't you just take a class in something that interests you? And then you'll have a better idea if you want to go back to grad school. So I took a class and I loved it. And so that was that. I continued to pursue getting my officials licenses. And I also, pursued this master's degree in performance psychology, which I wound up getting through Harvard University. And it was a remote and in-person program. So it was just perfect because I got to do, you know, I got this very high quality education, but I got to do it in conjunction with my lifestyle. And becoming an official was not at all something that I had foreseen, but once I'm ICP certified, the first course that I took was actually just a continuing education credit towards my ICP certification. But that, when I took it, I thought, you know, this is really interesting, a great perspective for me. I could learn. So why don't I take the next course? Because the first two courses that you take are dressage. And I definitely could have used some help with Gucci's dressage. So then after I took the second course, which was taught by Marilyn Payne, and Marilyn says, you need to become an official. And it was like the voice of God had spoken. She said, there are not enough officials that have the riding background that you have. You really need to look into this. And so it made me think about it, and I thought, you know, I probably would enjoy it. And I feel like I'm a fair person. So I thought if I become good at this, it would be a way that I could stay in the sport 20 or 25 or 30 years from now at a very high level and really enjoy it. So it wasn't like a black and white, I'm going to stop riding. Which I have to say that embarrassingly, when I was younger, that was like my view of officials. I'm like, they ride? they're just this group of people, you know, it's like us versus them. And so now being an official, it's a completely different perspective because it's really the officials are really this group of people that love the sport and are trying to run the sport to the best degree possible for the benefit of the competitors. And also because they love the sport, they love the horses. So it's really, really been an eye opener for me.
Yeah. That's important to remember that. Like, I mean, you know, even Marilyn Payne, I think last year she was eventing out there.
She still does.
She's still eventing.
Yeah, she's still out there.
Val Viscerondo Pride, she's an eventer, still active, at the top of the sport. So, I had a very similar thought, too, that, okay, these are the judges. They gave up, they rode, now they judge, you know. But I guess, I was naive, And when Marilyn Payne tells you to do something, you just do it.
Yes.
When Marilyn speaks, you listen.
Just do it.
So now, you're okay. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say last fall I was judging with Marilyn at Terra Nova. And one of the days we were in the car together driving to the show, and she, Marilyn just gets right to the point. She gets in the car and she goes, so when are you going to test up? So Marilyn's, she's definitely a mentor. Even when I started the program, I think that she's a really great judge and I really admire her. And so when she says, Ashley, you need to do this, I take it seriously. But I'm also a horse addict. And so a couple months ago, a horse came into my barn and I thought, this is my next horse. And so I bought her. So I'm still riding also.
Nice. Do you have the aspirations of getting back to 5-star level?
I think that this horse could definitely do it. So nice. If I, as she progresses, that is in the back of my mind. If that's what happens, then I'm going for it.
That's cool. I love that you said also that, hey, the judges, it isn't us against them. I really love that because I think that's a very, very important thing to get out there that I don't think is said enough. So, and then also your sports psychology, can you tell us a little bit about that? Do you have regular clients or can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I do. I have clients. I have some clients that I speak to regularly. I have other clients that just need, one or two sessions. I do hour sessions. And I've also started doing some work for the Ride IQ podcast. So I have a bunch of recordings with them. There's one on resilience. There's one on flow. There's one on mindfulness and like kind of being physically present. And I think the fourth one is on different types of performance strategies. And then we have a whole curriculum that we're working on. I haven't recorded the other ones yet, but there's more coming.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. Cool. So, well, we got to shout out the ladies at Ride IQ. Yeah. So, Jessa and McKinsey, we've kind of partnered with them a little bit and that we're going to start having more of their Ride IQ, instructors on and things like that. Mm-hmm. So shout out to Ride IQ. Definitely go check that out. That sounds very interesting. So all of your courses are in the sports psychology realm, not the riding side of things right now?
Correct. Yeah. Okay. So on Ride IQ, my entire curriculum is on performance psychology.
Wow. Okay. So think about that. What a resource, for anyone who, sometimes it could be number one, either time or expensive or scary to talk to somebody to have the opportunity to just listen and say, okay, these are the topics that I struggle with. And it's hard to sometimes even let your closest friends or family know that you struggle.
Right.
So I think that's really, really cool that Ride IQ is doing that and that you're doing that for Ride IQ. Question, did you ever struggle with sport, like the psychological game yourself? Is that why you got into this or?
Absolutely. I think it's twofold. So going back to that first class that I took when my mom said, well, why don't you just take a class in something that you're interested in? The first class that I took was called The Psychology of Close Relationships. And I just love thinking about how creatures relate to each other. So, I think that the relationship we have with our horse is a close relationship. That our family, our friends, we are social creatures. And so psychology in general is just a field that's very fascinating to me. I'll be standing in line at the grocery store and there'll be a magazine that has some article about, the science of marriage or something like that. And I'll pull it down and read it while I'm in line. But then once I got into the program, one of the first classes I took was on resilience, and it just seemed to naturally fit for me. It was something that I found really interesting from a scientific point of view, because I had experienced performance psychology as a rider. And, I listened to Daniel Stewart at the USEA annual meetings, and I read books by tennis coaches and top performance coaches, and definitely finding the right mindset for going into a big competition I tend to be, like I had to learn how to create kind of a force field around myself because I tend to be an empath, or I tend to absorb the emotions of people around me. And so I had to learn how to not, you know, not worry, like what any, you know, what my mom, if my mom was worried about me or anybody else, I had to learn how to kind of protect myself from the emotions of the people around me so that they wouldn't influence how I felt. And to me, I envisioned it like a force field or like a bubble. And so over the years I had done a lot of performance psychology. I never worked with a coach specifically, but I read and listened and absorbed performance psychology and sports psychology work. So then when I got into the master's program, and one of the first classes that I took was on psychological resilience. And it was, it just, to me, went right into what event riders have to have. Then I started kind of creating a curriculum for myself. And I wound up creating a thesis that was very performance psychology oriented.
What would you mind sharing what that was about? I mean, that you got me hanging on the edge of my seat. I got to know.
Whoa. Yep. It was, my thesis was finding out about the relationship between flow state resilience levels and types of performance strategies used by elite event riders. And so what I did was I invited every FEI rider, 2021, every FEI rider at every FEI competition in North America through Kentucky. So from the beginning of the year through Kentucky, they were invited to fill out metrics on flow state resilience levels and what types of performance strategies they used in the competitions. And I actually got really good response because getting event riders to do anything like on their phone or in emails is virtually impossible. And 100 riders responded. So I was super proud of all of the eventers that responded on this. I could not find any research articles that had ever studied event riders in sports psychology realms. So it was like the first of its kind. And I think we're pretty interesting because it's a really, really unique sport. And so some of the takeaways were that eventers are on par, or at least in my study, the resilience level for the event riders was on par with like Navy SEALs, where we are extremely resilient people. And I had thought that the 5-star riders were going to be the most resilient, and I was wrong. Everybody was resilient. So that was a really interesting finding to me. It was like, it's a self-selecting group. Like you are, if you get into eventing, you can, and you know, the definition of resilience is how you bounce back from adversity. So we are a group that can bounce back well from adversity.
Yeah. Well, I think that doesn't surprise me, because I think that you definitely weed out, you know, you're never going to meet an eventer who's not at least hardy. You know, I mean, we get a lot of eventers on the show, and a lot of people, we've had multiple sports psychologists on, Daniel Stewart and many others. Mm-hmm. And we've had a lot of riders that tell us that they speak to, you know, get psychological, you know, help and coaching and things like that. So it's not surprising to me, but it's not surprising that they are hardy, whether you get a little help or not. I mean, you have three phases, you know, so you have to be really good at all three phases, and you can botch any one of those three and your whole weekend's shot. And you have, then you're dealing with the horse and everything from a loose nail to the, you know, a slippery spot on the course. I mean, who knows,
Like
loading accident or, you know, just a little, all the things we all know, everyone listening to this knows all the things. So you have got to be resilient. It's like you're way The odds are way better for you to fail than they are to do well, you know? It sounds terrible, but it's true, you know? And I think that you have to, you're not doing this sport if you can't take a couple bumps along the way, physically and mentally, you know? Because it's a tough sport. It's tough. So
I like how you just phrased that. I think I might use that. It's the odds are way better that you're going to fail than succeed.
I mean, yeah, we put that on a poster, right, for come be an inventor, you know, come fail with us.
And just put Rob Bauer socks right under that line. Yeah.
That's it. You can credit me with that uplifting message.
Oh, that's horrible.
Well, you think about it. Look, if you can show jump, that's all you have to do is you have to have, you know, is work on show jumping. Right, and I know that simplifies That simplifies it. But at the end of the day, it's great. It's a lot of work too, but to be a specialist is you have a specialty, you know, to be someone who's a specialist in three fields is hard.
It's tough.
Eventing show jumping is not quite show jumping level, but it's pretty high. It's pretty big, pretty challenging. Same with the dressage, you know, and you're dealing with some horse that can gallop for 5, 10, 15 minutes.
Yeah. And the horse I just saw cross country as it's going to dressage.
Right. And you're trying to, you know, you're trying to now get it collected and all that stuff.
So, the breathing dragon that you're trying to relax, you know? In front of a judge.
Sees that little white chain and says, I want to jump that so bad. Wow. That's amazing. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. That's really cool. And it's cool that you did that study. We just had on someone else who just did a study about, why young riders who win at young riders tend to not follow through with the career. And she did a dissertation on that. And I find that type of stuff very fascinating. So I could talk sports psychology all the time. Question for you. I was just talking to my buddy, Steve Berkowitz, Karen at Fairhill.
Okay.
And Steve's like, Rob, I got so many questions. He really wants to get inside the head of riders. And, you know, a question was like that he had was, you know, when we're talking to the 5-star riders and stuff, like what's going on in your head between two jumps when you're on cross country and as you're coming up and I won't ask you that question particularly, but is there a right thing to be thinking about? Or is everyone just individual and it's just a matter of what works for them? Like as a psychology standpoint, is it better for someone to be focusing, counting on strides, or is it the person who can see it's like chess and they're thinking three moves ahead? Do you have any thoughts on that? I know I'm putting you on the spot.
I think that's a great. No. I think that's a great question, and that is so. Flow state. What I feel on a good cross country round is flow state, or show jumping round, or dressage test, and that's kind of being in the zone. You know where you. You're very present in the, you're there in the present moment. And one of the things that I learned when I was researching flow state was that, so, you know, musicians experience flow state, painters experience flow state. You can experience flow state doing smaller things as well, but you know, these great artists and these great performers have a tendency to experience flow state. And when you're in flow, there is an element where you know what you need to do next. So like when you're a painter or if you're a performer, if you're Jimi Hendrix, you know, like he just would know like, well, hey, I need to do this note next. And so as an event rider, when you're on course and you're in flow, you know, you're like, well, I just need to bring my shoulders up here a little more. I need, you know, you're on the right rhythm. The balance is correct. So I think that the riders who are the very best riders do what they need to do pretty much automatically by that stage. And, you know, obviously it takes years and years and years to learn how to do it automatically. But by the time you get to be the very best in the world, you are doing it just second nature because you feel you're in the moment and you feel what needs to be done.
Yeah. You know, we were also talking like with Steve and I was talking to some other people about coaching and things. And, you know, I was almost wondering if sometimes, because what you said just reminded me of this, it just brought this point out. Like, if you're getting coached by someone who's at the very, very top and they're, and that's kind of muscle memory now, do you know, I wonder if sometimes that person who's that at that level where it's so automatic for them, if when they coach you, if sometimes they kind of forget to tell you that because it's so natural for them. Does that, I don't know if that makes sense. Maybe that's a bad thing. I should probably cut that out of the show, but I won't. Because when I say dumb stuff,
people. Well, okay. I'm going to actually give you my, my take on that. When I would walk my courses with certain instructors like Bruce Davidson or even Philip Dutton, when I was learning, if you watch them carefully, they would move in the way that they were going to ride. Like Philip, they would always go on the line. They just naturally would go on the line that they were going to find. They, you could see their body slightly change, you know, slightly shift and slightly move. So when I was course walking, I would pay very close attention. And, you know, there were other coaches when I was learning, and working for Mr. Weatherall, I rode a lot with Jimmy Wofford. And he is more analytical. So he would verbalize it more. So, you know, you get it from different senses, but there are certain top riders. If you watch them, they will kind of ride the course as they're walking it.
Gotcha. Very cool.
Yeah.
And yes, sense. They do forget to articulate.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was kind of, you brought up Philip. Like, I think this person we were talking to, this wasn't Steve, it was someone else. And they were like, they said they were walking the course with Philip and they were like, so Philip, how are we going to approach this? And he looked back because he had already kind of kept walking and he said, jump the F and jump. They were like, okay.
Yep, that's pretty much what Philip would say. I remember when I was a kid, when I was in my 20s, and I would ask him a question, well, you know, what should we do here? And he'd go, ride to the jump.
But a lot of people come through his barn. So that's yes. I mean, a lot of very successful people who have gone through his program. So that's, I mean, and we actually, by the time this comes out, the episode will come out. We just interviewed
his working students,
slash rider crew. Yeah. Yeah. So that was interesting.
That was fun.
So, hey, and one last topic before we move on is that your coaching. You mentioned that you're coaching a college team. You also coached one of the
Area 3 young riders.
Yeah, so you tell us a little bit about your coaching gigs you have there.
Yeah. So, okay, you know, in Ocala, there are a lot of horse people. I started teaching when I was 16 in the United States Pony Club, and then in my 20s, I got ICP certified, and I'm really passionate about trying to articulate the best way that I can, how the partnership, you know, helping to develop and helping to articulate to riders the classical development of the partnership, and also meeting each rider where they are. So I have adult amateur students. I have this fabulous 14-year-old kid. She's my youngest kid. And I coach a lot of students who are in kind of late teenage, early 20s stage at all different levels. And I also have helped, you know, I also help some professionals, whether it's performance psychology or just, you know, maybe sometimes a professional will come to me and they have a thoroughbred, and I've worked a lot with hot thoroughbreds, and they just want a little advice or some help. But with the University of Florida team and the Area 3 Young Riders, the Area 3 Young Rider coaching is new this year. I just got selected, and I'm doing a clinic for the riders this coming Saturday. They are declaring the riders that want to potentially be in contention for the championships in the fall are about to declare if they want to be considered. It's an exciting program, and I think that kind of combining my pony club background, the college coaching background, and my involvement in the Young Rider group, that my basic thought is that, yes, we have kids that are going to be riding at high levels, but we also have a lot of kids that just need to learn how to take care of horses well and how to be good horse people and want to have a good group of friends in the sport. So I think that it's important on a lot of levels.
Yeah,
sure is.
I think that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. I love the way that you're approaching that. Like, hey, I'm going to take all of this. And then, you have young people that are under a lot of pressure because they're trying to perform at Young Riders and all that. And I think to have the mental, your ability to kind of help, judge them emotionally as well, if that's the right way to put it. I think that's pretty awesome.
Help them put it in perspective.
Yeah. Right. You might have for some of these young people, it could be a very, very huge pivotal time for them to have a coach that has, your skill set, the riding and the mental game. Mm-hmm. So I think that what you might offer to these young people might be lifelong and life changing.
Yeah.
And I mean that. I don't know. Like I'm looking at this as big picture. If we had a coach or somebody like that who could maybe help at that moment at that moment where that kid's about to lose it, your skills, your background will definitely be valuable. So I think that's fantastic. Very cool.
That's definitely one of the things that I love about the age group, and also definitely in the past few years with my performance psychology background now, I just come at things with, from a slightly different angle, because I have more tools that can help on the performance psychology side. And I think that the kids get under so much pressure, and I agree, and that's one of the things I love about it. It's a really formative age, and the tools that they could learn at this moment could stand them in good stead for the rest of their life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
You might have a few of those kids that win that stay in the sport and don't get burned out or whatever, could keep with it. So that's exciting. Well, best of luck with that Area 3 this
year.
That'd
be exciting. Yes, definitely. All right, so Ashley, we're gonna play Quick Fire Questions.
Quick Fire Questions.
And Quick Fire Questions is brought to you by Turtleneck. Get your premium horse clothing by going to turtleneck.biz. So it's just 5 random questions. You don't have to be quick, but Rob does grade you at the very end.
Strict grading.
Very strict grading. All right. All right, so first question, who was your favorite rider growing up?
Bruce Davidson.
Good answer. Off to a good start.
Brownie points already.
All right.
All right. If eventing was not an option, what other riding discipline would you want to try?
Show jumping.
Okay.
There we go. Good answer.
Very good. Very good. All right. Do you have any good luck rituals or superstitions before you leave the start box?
I pet my horse.
That's a good one.
That's a very nice one.
That's a nice one. That's a good one.
Excellent.
All right. What is your one favorite thing about the sport of eventing?
That it's complicated.
That's a new answer. We never got that one before. All right, Ashley, listen, you have one question left, and before she goes, I just want to let you know you were doing very, very well, so don't blow it. We're going to test your mental strength. Don't blow it
on this last one. All right, last question. If you could ride any horse, past, present, or fiction, who would it be?
I'm going to use a Bruce Davidson quote and say, I haven't found that horse yet.
Oh.
Wow. She threw us for some loops, Karen.
She threw a zinger in there.
Zinger. All right. Well, Karen, you give her the grade.
Well, she got brownie points for the first question.
Yep. Okay.
So A plus plus plus.
Plus with a plus. Excellent job. Well done. Good job by you. Hey, quick question for you. Back to your judging stuff. Do you ever do fix-a-test rides for people? Like, can someone catch up with you and do a fix-a-test?
I absolutely do fix-a-test, and I do virtual fix-a-test also.
Oh, nice. Ooh,
how does a virtual fix-a-test work? Is that just a very simple, like, how would somebody want to do that? Like, would they be at sea, or where would they be? What would be going on here?
You get somebody to stand at sea and video you, and you send it to me, and I critique it.
Oh. Okay.
What's that run? How much do you charge?
That's $60.
$60, there you
go. Yeah. $60.
And that's tests up to what level? Any level? Up to what level?
Well, I mean, any eventing test.
Any eventing test. There we go.
Or any eventing test.
Okay.
Bam. There we go.
There we go.
I love a good fix-a-test. I think that's a very valuable, valuable asset. So super. So, all right. Awesome.
All right. So, Ashley, do you have any advice for that young rider trying to make it in this sport?
I do. My best advice is figure out what you really love about the sport, because that is going to be what gets you through the hardest moments of it. And, you know, keep remembering why you love the sport and why you love the horses and why you know, the thing as a whole. It's because I think that it is a big sport. And it's easy to get kind of one track minded about, I want to move up or I want to do this competition. And there are a lot of times that there's going to be disappointment. And if you just really think about what the sport means to you and why you're doing it, I think that that's going to go a really long way.
Excellent. Excellent answer.
Yeah.
So listen, that was fantastic. We're gonna have to start winding things down.
Okay? Yeah.
But Ashley, I hope we're gonna wind things down. We have one or two like questions here as we wind things down. But I hope that maybe someday you come back on, because I feel like we just scratched the surface. Like, I love the sports psychology stuff. I love learning about being an official and picking people's, you know, officials' brains and stuff like that. So hopefully you have a good time. Maybe you can come back again sometime. Maybe. Fingers crossed.
Oh, I'd love to come back. Oh,
awesome.
That'd be awesome. Awesome. So with two questions left. We always ask about sponsors, supporters that you would like to shout out, anyone that's behind you that you would like to mention.
I would love to. Custom Saddlery. I love my custom saddles. Gucci also loves his custom saddles. IRH helmets. I've been working with them for about 20 years. They do great, lightweight, safe, top-of-the-line helmets. DAC supplements. Crypto Aero. Whole Food Horse Feed. I also love my Free Ride equestrian clothing. My Posture Prep groomer. And last but not least, Sport Innovations, electromagnetic blankets, and multi-radiance veterinary lasers. Wow. All keep my horses in top form.
That's quite the list. That's a good list. That's a real good list.
Yes, it is.
I love it. You know, there's not enough of that in the sport where people get a chance to just highlight their sponsors. And I love it because we get to hear different names. You know, you get these brands and stuff that jog your memory. So, you know, we're going to look at the supplement companies and the therapies and all. So I appreciate you sharing that with us.
And I was just going to say, I really appreciate the support of my sponsors. I've worked with many of my sponsors for over a decade, and they're just, you know, they're companies that are good companies and they want to be in the sport and they want to support the sport. And so it's really a pleasure to work with them.
Yeah. Well, the sport doesn't fly without these good companies backing our riders and
definitely
shows,
need them.
Absolutely. So, well, thank you for sharing that. Last question, like, how do people follow along? Do you have socials, website? How do people follow?
Yeah, I've got, So I'm on Facebook, so Ashley Johnson, and there are a lot of Ashley Johnsons, but it's Ashley Johnson in Ocala. And there's also Ashland Eventing is my group. And then my website is www.ashlandeventing.com.
Awesome. Awesome.
Very cool.
And then for the folks that are curious about your Ride IQ, so Ride IQ is ride-iq.com. So, you know, hop on there, and I think they do some specials and all types of mm-hmm. good stuff. So hop on there, find Ashley's and all those other coaching audios. So that sounds like a lot of some really, really good information out there, Ashley. So, oh man. So we kept Ashley on a little bit longer.
I know.
We kept her on past
it's
her
dark
bedtime.
Now.
Yeah. We can't even see you, Ashley. It's dark. She's just a shadow. We just see a black screen. But Ashley's out there. You're still
there,
aren't you? You're still there, right, Ashley? She's still
I'm
there.
Here. It's been a beautiful sunset in Ocala at the farm.
Oh,
thank you. That's awesome. Well, listen, Karen, was this fantastic?
This was great.
Ashley, I mean it sincerely. Awesome. I really hope that you come back on and visit us again, because I feel like we just kind of scratched the surface of a lot of topics.
But, yeah.
Hopefully we get you back on soon, and we can get more into some nitty gritty about some of these, you know, I love talking sports psychology. I love talking judging, and I love picking the judges mm-hmm. and, you know, you're also a TD, you know, I love getting inside the head of a judge. So hopefully we can come back and we can get on more of that a little in depth next time.
Well, it was really fun to talk to you guys. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed today's show. Please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google, or your favorite podcast app. Cheers!